Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to increase major planned and principal giving. QBAC acts as a force multiplier for fundraisers, enabling them to focus on what they do best, developing deep relationships with prospects and cultivating them into lifelong donors. QBAC automates the qualification process beyond simple scoring to ensure that your fundraisers have the best prospects. QBAC also uncovers actionable insights about current and future prospects to help fundraisers develop personalized cultivation strategies. Start closing bigger gifts in less time by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. Also, how about being our next host for the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow? I'm looking forward to two things this summer: getting back to the ballpark with my kids and getting the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow back on the calendar. If your organization would like to be a host location, let's schedule a time to chat. The Responsive Fundraising Roadshow provides 6 hours of the best fundraising training out there based on Responsive's 4 sense-making tools. Hosting Responsive's Roadshow is not like hosting a major conference that requires months of planning and all types of resources. All we need you to do is provide us with a safe learning environment for 25 adult professionals in your community who want to understand how highly effective fundraising really works. There is no cost to your organization, and we will reimburse you for all related expenses. If your organization would like to host the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow in your community, reach out and let's have a conversation today. Hi, Paul. I am delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast today. You and I have, this is our second attempt at recording this conversation. So in the process, we've gotten to know each other a little bit. You've even helped me identify some great restaurants in the little small town where I'm doing some consulting work. So we've developed some rapport and a little bit of a friendship here. So I am delighted that that we've got the technology cooperating for both of us here so we can have this conversation today. But before we dive into our topic, how about we just let you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. First of all, I'm glad to be here, and I have enjoyed our conversations. I hope the technology holds out. you know, we're a slave to it.
But yes, we are.
If I had to describe myself, I am a recovering tax lawyer.
Yeah.
I practiced tax and estate planning law for 20 years in Louisiana and the greater New Orleans area until Hurricane Katrina, which changed my life unknowingly on August 29th, 2005. And the other thing I would say about myself is that I describe myself as a purposeful estate planner.
Mm-hmm.
I helped people take care of their needs as far as where they wanted their property to go, when they wanted people to get it. But the most important part, and what separated me as a purposeful estate planner, was I wanted to make sure that what we did either enhanced or didn't damage the relationships of those who survived the client. Because too many perfectly drafted estate plans rip family relationships apart because they don't pay attention to the personal dynamics. And I think it's sad. Too many estate planners engage in what I call the Jenny Craig estate planning method, which is they take the client's tax situation before they're planning and they see what the tax exposure is. They put them through their planning paces, which reduces the tax. They take a before and after snapshot, declare victory, and move on without considering what the, I mean, a classic misstep, putting a sibling as trustee for the benefit of another sibling. And that's a recipe for disaster. I mean, unless there's a special need situation where someone is impaired, simply taking a sibling in a normal family situation and making them in charge of the money and the cash flow over another sibling is going to end the sibling relationship. So, and that's just one example. I mean, we're not here to talk about estate planning, but that's the bottom line, is that purposeful to me was very important. And when I got into development, I carried that purposeful aspect on, because it's just part of me. It's part of my DNA.
Yeah. So yes, right. And that's sort of, that's some of the stuff that we talked about on the previous recording that never made it to the air. But you also voiced some pretty profound and very thoughtful opinions about, I think most of the conversation that we were having on that previous record, and forgive me for listeners, please forgive us that we were unable to broadcast that particular episode. But a lot of that conversation was about fundraising ethics. And Paul, I got to be honest with you, in the 250 plus episodes, I think we've had ethically related conversations. You can't have that many conversations that are not related to ethics, and ethics certainly comes up, but there hasn't been a lot of robust conversations specifically about, you know, sort of diving into the ethics of what it is we're doing. And so, as I shared with you a few moments ago before we hit the record button, as I wrap up this current writing project and I think about perhaps the next one, I think I want to do a little bit deeper dive into the ethics of fundraising. So where do we go with that?
Well, for starters, I think that ethics plays a huge role in fundraising. And I'll give you one example. When I was the director of planned giving, I had a policy of not going to visit or pursue donors who had reached age 85. And part of the reason for that was my fear of being accused after the fact of undue influence. We have seen a number of very famous cases. I'm trying to think of the New York dilettante who ended up her last 15 or 20 years staying in a hospital that ended up getting the bulk of her estate. And the family objected. And my former boss, Vern Snyder, who was... he was my boss at the University of Toledo Foundation for 2 years. Vern was a better boss for me than I was for the 20 years when I was my own boss. But Vern had a saying that made great sense. He said that we have to remember that if the proverbial SHIT hits the fan, we're in the front row wearing white suits. And he's right, because there is a
we as in the fundraisers. Right.
Because there is a tension, particularly in planned giving, between the family and the charity. Because what the charity gets, the family doesn't.
Right.
And I remember meeting with And I was asked to attend a luncheon in the president's office with an elderly donor, and the president had already tapped this donor for several million dollars worth of lifetime gifts.
Yeah.
And he was all teed up to make another pitch. Well, the problem was the donor, when we met with him, was in his upper 90s. And even though he had full capacity and I was comfortable talking to him, despite my regular rule, he brought along two of his children. And we determined that the donor had given away most of his wealth. And the remainder of the wealth was held by the junior generation.
Yes,
and
right.
And the junior generation made it very clear during this meeting that they had no intention of sharing any more of that wealth with the University of Toledo.
Right. You're not getting any more of my mom and dad's money is what they were saying.
Right, right. And that's exactly right. Yeah. We have to be very sensitive to that. And, you know, I mean, ethics issues in fundraising happen with great regularity. I mean, we've seen just recently these grateful patient programs, some of which stink to high heaven. I mean, they're paying doctors a referral fee for names of potential grateful patient donors. I mean, that's terrible. The public should know about that. I mean, these are tax-exempt entities that enjoy a benefit granted by the law. And for that benefit, they have to follow some rules.
Yeah.
And the whole grateful patient thing is walking right on the line of undue influence, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely right. Yes, I just had a guest here on the podcast. I mean, her conversation with me will broadcast a day or two before this one will, and she was referring to highly intrusive, creepy sort of practices that ultimately diminish the joy that a fundraising professional sort of experiences in their work, because she was basically saying most fundraising professionals really are not interested in some of the information that you're inclined to put in front of them prior to that bedside visit. But what occurs to me as I'm listening to you talk about that story, because I've been writing about sort of the complexity around charitable giving for quite some time as I wrap up this current book project, and we all know that, you know, complex gifts tend to happen late in life, but the baby boomer generation is going to live. You know, my baby boomer in-laws, for example, are perhaps in better health than I'm in right now. They're going to live a lot longer, and you're going to have, you know, highly savvy. So you've got the boomer generation that's going to start giving away wealth in the ways that you're talking about, but you've got my generation sort of right on their heels, who perhaps is going to be a more savvy sort of second gen, you know, sort of the inheriting generation, if you will, than perhaps even the previous generation. And these people are going to live, you know, the boomers have extraordinary healthcare available to them. So we're talking, I guess what I'm saying is, Paul, we're probably looking at 3 or 4 decades right now of extraordinary complexity when it comes to these types of gifts. And that to me seems like that's going to just bring to the forefront all of the issues that you're starting to sort of unravel here in this conversation. Am I right?
Oh, you're absolutely right. Because once again, there is a tension. There is a tension between where the wealth goes.
Yeah.
What the family doesn't get, the charity gets, and vice versa.
Right.
And the family, you know, Mark Twain said it best. He said, you never really know someone until you share an inheritance with them. And I learned when I was in the University of Toledo Foundation family that we were temporary parts of our donors' families. And people would talk about making this big gift without consulting their children. And I used to advise against that. You know, people are motivated to make charitable gifts for a number of reasons.
Yeah.
Some of them are altruistic, but not all of them are. Some people love the attention they get. They like being put on a pedestal. And unfortunately, that pedestal isn't big enough to hold the family. The family might get a little benefit from the fact that mom and dad, I had one, I wouldn't call him a donor, although he was a UT donor, but his dad was a professor at UT.
Yeah.
And left his entire estate to UT.
Yeah.
And my friend always reminded me that we had his money.
Right. Paul, I don't know if you saw this in the news. I saw this come across social media this morning. So Western Michigan, University of Western Michigan just received like a $550 million gift. $550 million gift, which I think, as I read the article, is the largest gift given to a public institute, you know, public university on record or whatever. Only perhaps private institutions have gotten anything bigger. And they're going to receive that gift over the next 10 years. It's an anonymous gift. You know, somebody obviously knows who's giving it. But when you think about that type of wealth being given from what apparently is one individual family, and you think about multiple generations, you think about a size of a gift that size, and it may not even be grandma and grandpa and the sons and daughters. It might also be grandchildren by the time when you talk about the complexity of the number of people around the table and the ethics of sort of who wants to have their say or who's entitled to their say in some of these decisions. And going back to sort of like the bedside manner sort of grateful patient stuff, highly reductionist in my opinion, because you're focusing on one individual. There's no individual at that sort of giving level, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but no individual at that giving level is making decisions independently. Am I right?
Well, it's possible they are if they created all the wealth themselves. But yeah, with $550 million, you know, unless they came out of Silicon Valley or something, because, you know, in Silicon Valley, it's monopoly money. When I lived in Napa, I routinely dealt with computer software engineers who one day were worth $150,000. And when the company went public and their options vested, they were all of a sudden worth $300 million. And the transformation from $150,000 to $300 million
was
substantial. And most of these people were not ready for that shock.
Yeah.
They were not, they psychologically could not come to grips with it. Some of them, actually I had two of them commit suicide. They just couldn't. It was too much. So unless they were in a situation like that, the odds are they inherited the money. And inheritors are more like stewards of family wealth. If they weren't the creators, they simply were the managers or the stewards of the wealth. And if somebody who happened to be the trustee or the current person who had the purse strings diverted $500 million to a state institution, I can easily foresee the family the other members of the family either crying foul or absolutely going bananas. Because that's a lot of wealth. And it's not to say that, Western Michigan isn't deserving. And they were in the MAC. You know, I remember them, and they were in Toledo's conference.
Yeah.
But it's still strange credulity to conduct such philanthropy in a vacuum with just the donor.
Yeah.
Even though the donor may have the full legal right. Once again, I go back to Vern. It's the appearance of impropriety that is the worst part of it. You know, and if someone is unhappy and they start casting accusations at the charity,
the charity's in
a no-win situation, because it benefited, and by benefiting is in part guilty. Even if the transaction passed full legal muster, the bottom line is that intergenerational communication, even among people who don't have any say, just notice, give them notice.
Yeah.
Because once again, it's a bigger issue than who's right. It's the situation needs to be right. Because if the charity starts getting bad publicity, and once again, the hospital in New York, in this one case I'm thinking about, I mean, they took it on the chin.
Yeah.
I mean, they held on for dear life, you know, because it was hundreds of millions of dollars. And unfortunately, when they did the trial, they showed the progression of the estate plan change history, and the charity share kept increasing over time, little by little by little, until it was a lot. And that doesn't look good, and it doesn't smell good. Now, the lady was living in the hospital.
Yeah.
And she probably had very fond feelings for people in the hospital. But the attention that the hospital foundation was paying her was inordinate. Looking at the facts of the case. As I wish I could remember the name of it. I've written an article about it, but it was many years ago.
So, Paul, when you and I talked before, and I may have used this word, when you and I talked before, when I talked to your, I don't want to sort of box you in a generation, but I think you're good for this. When I talk to individuals like yourself, I hear angst about where you're looking at fundraising today and where fundraising was when you perhaps retired, sort of stepped away from the full-time work. Can you unpack that for me?
Sure. I believe bluntly that fundraising in the United States is in the ditch. And
right, okay. Right. So I guess angst is a
and the reason for that, once again, I think it goes back. Well, what's the proof of my point? Job dissatisfaction among development people is at an all-time high. I mean, that's pretty clear.
Yeah, and okay.
The amount of movement, job movement from job to job, the average length of tenure of a development person, I want to say the last statistic I saw was somewhere around 2 years.
You're right, right.
And there's, I mean, one of the reasons for that is, and it goes back to ethics. I think that unfortunately, too many of the development officer metrics today measure things that don't count. And they hold development professionals to meet requirements that are really not important. just because it can be counted doesn't mean it's worth counting. And I blame that all on Moves management, because yeah. they basically, and it's not Moves management as a theory that's the problem.
Yeah.
It's the, you got to have 50 qualification visits and 35 discovery visits. I mean, it's the attempted analyzation of development as sales. And development, quite frankly, is not sales. And it will never be sales. And a development professional who is forced into the sales model, by and large, is not going to be happy. And this
why is that? I couldn't agree more. And I have to say that the when I look back on my nearly now 25 years doing this work, you know, it's never been it. You know, I think we've all had our sales like experiences where we're literally sitting across the table from a donor and we almost feel like a used car salesman. You know, but why is that? Because I think you're onto something there. Why is it that notion that fundraising is like sales ultimately is going to let us down?
It's going to let you down because, in truth, it's not a philanthropy is not a two-way exchange.
Yeah.
You can say, you know, the donor gets feeling good and he gets altruistic feelings and some attention and all this kind of thing, but it's ultimately the donor's money. In a sales transaction, you've got something that I want at a certain price, and I've got the cash or wherewithal to buy what you have at the price I want. If we have a meeting of the minds, there's a sale.
Yeah.
And I get the product and you get the cash. But in philanthropy, there are aspects of sales that are consistent and actually help with development.
Sure. Right.
There certainly are aspects of it that help. But trying, you know, I've seen development shops look to sales professionals as potential development officers. And without some acclimation as to the differences between the two endeavors, which once again, I believe are very different in essence.
Yeah.
What you're going to end up with is either a rogue fundraiser who has casual moral ethics about getting a gift, because it's all about making the sale.
Yeah.
And you'll say whatever you want to say or need to say because it's the ends justifying the means. And that's a problem in philanthropy, because if a donor is coerced into making a gift, either a larger gift than they would have made or making a gift that they wouldn't have made but for the coercion, there's this little thing called donor's remorse. And it's real.
Mm-hmm.
And not only can a donor have a remorse, but the family can have a remorse. And you can actually be penny wise and pound foolish by forcing a gift that in the end causes the loss of the relationship with the donor. And to me, once again, I strived, and maybe it's just my ethical training as an estate planner and one who cared deeply and cares deeply about ethics and doing the right thing.
Yeah.
But those matters are very, very important, because it's about the long-term benefit. I used to tell that, because I was in a position to give And in part because of my age and life experiences, I was able to give advice and counsel to some of the younger development people.
Yep.
And I would always tell them, view every potential step with respect to a donor through the lens of, is this in the donor's long-term best interest? And I will tell you that my advice conflicted with the advice they were getting from their own bosses and our foundation.
Of course. See, if you connect the dots, when I talk to a guy like you, when I talk to anyone who shares opinions like yours, and I get the, because we have these conversations a couple times a week, when I connect the dots between the critique that you're making, when we're talking about ethics and when we're talking about the practical use of well screening tools and, you know, grateful patient programs, and when I connect the dots, I basically see, and this is kind of the underlying message in my forthcoming book, is that I'm seeing a fundraising profession that has basically decided that the donor and the consumer are one and the same. And somehow or another, we've just sort of assumed, and when things like sales come up, you know, obviously, when the notion of sales comes up, we haven't even critically thought through the idea that we just think that the donor is a consumer because everything else in our modern 20th century sort of worldview says to us that we're basically consumers. And when I look at healthcare, I'm a professor over at the local college. When I look at some of the critiques that are being levied at healthcare and education and everywhere else in the world, probably in the legal community too, it's because they've all sort of co-opted this idea that who they're serving is a consumer, but the consumer definition of a human being doesn't necessarily work all that much always. You know, when I think of you as an attorney, I'm guessing that you didn't necessarily always look at the person across the table, you know, your client necessarily as a consumer. I like to think in many cases, what we're doing in philanthropy is we're looking at citizens. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, you're absolutely right. And once again, you know, by only taking steps that you are calculated and have considered to be in the donor's long-term best interest,
yeah,
and the donor's interest be preserved.
Yeah.
And for me, I'll give you one example. And I ruffled some feathers at the foundation for doing this. We had a couple in their early 60s, and their net worth was somewhere between $7 and $10 million. And I'm not sure exactly why I got involved, but I was asked to attend a meeting, and the donor had been teed up for roughly a little over a million dollar gift of marketable securities. And in my estate planning experience, red flags went off. These people were too young and didn't have enough money, in my opinion, to give away $1 million of liquidity. And what I remember, I had a client, Jason, who sold a shipyard in New Orleans in 1981 at the height of the oil boom. Oil busted in 1982, but he sold his shipyard for $35 million. Now, obviously, there was capital gains tax to pay and whatnot.
Yeah.
He had four, and I'll be charitable here, reprobate children. And they all fashioned themselves as entrepreneurs. And they all wanted to try this business and that business. And that required capital. Dad wasn't willing to part with it, but he was willing to guarantee debt at the bank. And frankly, he had enough collateral where the bank gladly did that deal. Well, fast forward to 1995, 14 years later, when Charlie died. he had other assets when he sold the shipyard. So his estate in 1981 was much bigger than $35 million. I mean, he had large tracts of development land, too. When I did his federal estate tax return, his net estate was a little over $3.5 million. The rest of it didn't go to taxes. It went to pay the banks for the bad loans that he made or he guaranteed for his kids.
Yeah.
Things happen. These people were in their early, I think the husband was 63 and the wife was 62. They have a long life expectancy. And the $1 million, it was like $1,040,000. It was a stock, an appreciated stock holding, concentrated. It was one stock, and they had a high capital gain potential in it. And so they had been talked into parting with this. Too many things can happen late in life. The stock market could go down. Your health could go to hell. And I saw it as part of my ethical responsibility, not only to the donors, but to my employer to intervene. And I suggested, as an alternative, a blended gift where they cut the size of the current gift from a little over $1 million to $250,000. And they left roughly a testamentary bequest at the survivor's death of about $2 million more dollars. Now, this meant that my foundation walked away with $750,000 less cash.
Yeah, right, sure.
But, and to be honest, when I proposed it, thankfully, it happened so quickly that I didn't have a chance to talk to my colleagues about my idea because I was just in this meeting for the first time. But I expressed discomfort with them parting with what was, in essence, about 85% of their liquidity in one fell swoop, because mm-hmm. the rest of their assets, they had a closely held business, mm-hmm. and those are subjectively valued.
Yeah.
And who knows how the cash flow from that business is going to continue. Now, those tend to be okay because they tend to be okay run and less risky than a stock portfolio when you don't understand the market. But and it was just my ethical training. When I suggested the other, the donors kind of initially, I think they had committed in their mind to making the $1 million gift, but I think more importantly, receiving the accolades, the public accolades for having made, when you cross that $1 million threshold, and the charity's able to go public with a gift that is $1 million or more, that catches people's attention. A quarter of a million dollar gift, not as much.
Yeah.
Even though that's a significant gift. But to these people lacked the wealth. I mean, I have a totally different view of what constitutes a wealthy person than most. For me, you're not wealthy unless you have passive, spendable income, not from work, equal to 5 times your current need and a minimum of $25 million worth of net worth. And sometimes, depending on the asset, I might raise that $25 million to even double it.
Okay. So is part of the So if we jump back to your comment earlier that fundraising is in some ways is in a ditch, is some of this because, okay, so if I've either got someone like yourself with the perspective on wealth and planned gifts, you know, all the perspective you sort of bring to it. And then I also bring to the table a 28 to 30 year old young person who basically is sort of in the mindset that they're basically just trying to close a deal really quickly. Are we basically just talking about a profession that has got to, that has just got to grow up and sort of figure out sort of who is the right person in these? Here's the thing, Paul, when I came into this role, when I came into fundraising at about the turn of the century, there were hordes, every conference I went to, there were planned giving officers. But I remember after September 11th, for example, and especially as we creeped closer and closer to the recession, we stopped, for example, having planned giving officers on the payroll. I started sort of hearing this narrative that this was sort of playing out, that the planned giving roles were sort of being phased out, or they were being morphed into the individual giving or the major gifts department or whatever. And I just wonder if we even know how to sort of flip that switch back on now, and if we even have the type of talent that we need. I'm listening to a guy like you, Paul, and I'm thinking, okay, if I ask you to put on the cap of a donor instead of being wearing the cap of a fundraiser, if your sort of perspective on this sort of is representative of the quintessential donor that we're interacting with, I don't think you're the same donor that perhaps your parents were, you know, 15, 20 years ago, when perhaps they might have been giving the same types of gifts. I think that's part of the messiness that I think we've got to anticipate in the next several decades too. Well, you follow me?
Yeah, your point about a decline in the number of dedicated planned giving professionals is accurate. In fact, when I left the University of Toledo Foundation, I was the only full-time dedicated planned giving officer in Greater Toledo, in Northwest Ohio. And I served two terms as president of our local National Council on Charitable, National Committee of Charitable Planned Gifts. I served two terms as president. That council disintegrated because the membership went away. When we disbanded, we had like 18 members and 11 of them were on the board.
Right.
And unfortunately, that is, my earpiece fell out, but I don't know if I can get it. Unfortunately, the talent, you raised the point about the talent.
Yes.
And too often a development person will go for a smaller current gift and avoid discussing a planned gift because they don't know much about planned gifts, or at least they don't think they do. And what I used to tell our team, because I was in charge of educating them, was more than 80% of planned gifts are bequests. And those are pretty simple.
Yeah, yeah.
I maintain that a planned giving person should know more about planned giving marketing than about how a charitable remainder trust works. Because I think I managed fewer than 10 of them. I had no lead trusts. So the bottom line is that too many development people leave money on the table. And just to close the loop on that story, the donors agreed to my plan. And at the final meeting, the husband had run the show. The wife is the one who thanked me. Even though she said, yeah, we made a bigger commitment than we were going to make, but you were looking after our long-term best interest. And she acknowledged my effort. My effort was obviously in part to help protect them, but it was also to protect the foundation. Because had those people parted with 85% of their liquidity and then had a market adjustment or a health plan, they're going to have donor's remorse. And if anything, the relationship between the donor and the foundation would have suffered. That's why I'm such a harper about you got to think about what's in the donor's long-term best interest. Because I believe that if the charity is in alignment with the donor's long-term best interest, that's the charity's long-term best interest too.
Okay, Paul. So remember what I said a few minutes earlier. I said I talked to individuals like yourself who I pick up this angst. I call it angst. And that may not be the consistent word. I remember talking to a woman, for example, who's probably about the same age as you are, who's in the southwest corner of Virginia, down in the Roanoke area. And I remember exchanging a long thread of conversation. She spent a lot longer in fundraising than perhaps you have. And I remember just sort of picking up on this angst. But what I'm also asking is, or what I'm interested in, sort of a way to wrap up this conversation. If there's a small grassroots organization in Toledo, are they wiser to figure out how to enlist you to work for them part time to help them raise some serious money rather than hire that 28-year-old who is going to approach this like sales?
The answer is yes.
Because you're going to be, let me say this, Paul, you're going to be, I know you well enough to know that you're going to be a pain in the ass to supervise, but I kind of wonder if we can teach these shops, if we can teach these EDs how to understand sort of in between the lines of everything you've said with me here in the last 45 minutes, and they knew how to appropriately supervise you strategically, I think you could bring more value to the organization. And I think there's a whole cohort of people out there that have this angst that if these grassroots organizations knew how to sort of lead and supervise these people, they could be raising remarkable amounts of dollars. And a lot of the donors we're talking about are your peers. They're your peers that are going to be giving away these gifts.
Well, you're right. And let me give you a simple idea that I have given to several smaller charities that have sought my counsel.
Yeah.
Put together a list of your top 50, your top 100, whatever the number is, 250.
Yeah.
Write a personal letter.
Yeah.
Tell them that you are in the business of accepting bequests.
Sure.
You don't even have to make an ask. You can just tell them that, and if you want to go into a story about, because bequests are far greater likelihood of being a transformational gift to a small organization than an annual gift or even a major gift. If you did that, and I mean, think about the resources it would take to write. Yeah, you sign 100 letters and you put 100 stamps on them. But I promise you the return on that small effort. I hate to call it an investment because it's not.
Yeah.
It's simply making people aware. Most donors are not aware that, like, their local food bank, I'll just pick on the food bank.
Yeah. But
the food banks are always in need.
Yes.
If they, I mean, and they have some very, very enthusiastic donors and volunteers. And if they took a letter to their top 100 prospects, and they just simply let them know, Because right now they're not thinking about them as a bequest area. They're thinking of them as the $100 end of year check, or right. Well, and that's, I mean, that's sad, but it's true. It doesn't take, you don't need, because in my opinion, and I realize we're running short of time, but I believe that development today is in the ditch in part because development professionals are forced to bother the donor too much.
Okay,
They pursue the donor, and the donor gets uncomfortable. And you know, you talked about wealth screening. Most donors don't even realize the amount of research that your average charitable organization does on its donor base. And I will tell you that if they knew, many of these donors would be offended.
See, the woman at the, so let's say the woman or the gentleman that's running the local food bank, this is what I'm trying to convey, listening to you, agreeing with you that in many ways fundraising finds itself in the ditch, understanding and sort of anticipating where planned giving opportunities are, you know, connecting all the dots and kind of sort of connecting all the dots in this conversation and seeing what the opportunity is. I guess what I really want to hear from you, Paul, as we wrap up is, what does Sally, who runs the local food bank, need to know about you, Paul, so that she can leverage your strengths, your giftedness now, say for another 10 years easily, perhaps better than that young 28-year-old who, like I said a few minutes ago, thinks fundraising is sales?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure how much of my time she needs.
I agree with you, right? She probably doesn't need a lot of it.
Right. And to be honest with you, I think that, you know, I can certainly be invaluable in helping them craft the right message in the letter.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the foundation, these smaller charities all have current strong needs. I mean, many of these people are raising money to keep the lights on.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Spending money on a development person that is in many ways going to alienate or aggravate the very people you're trying to get money from, you might well be better off having another event coordinator or a and seriously, you know,
I agree with that. Right. I totally, and that's what my first book is about. It's about this younger generation. It's about a younger generation of young people that are coming into the marketplace that are, you know, in the workplace. And I'm not talking about fundraisers in particular, but they have all sort of naive assumptions about the expediency and the efficiency with which some of this can get done. But there's extraordinary efficiency. If I can convince Sally at the food bank, for example, to enlist the help of Paul, who probably you only need a quarter, you know, a fraction of his time to sort of make this stuff work. But I think with the challenge that we're faced with right now when it comes to fundraising is, and I think that critique that fundraising is in the ditch doesn't have as much to do with you or even that 28-year-old. It has to do with how getting Sally's head on straight as to how all this works. He or she, the woman running the food bank, has a notion about how this works that's not consistent with what you and I are trying to describe.
Well, you're exactly right. And unfortunately, it's because people who are supervising the fundraisers have never raised a dime themselves. And they view this as a bottom line consideration. And, you know, all this talk, and you see it in the charitable world, we have to demonstrate our return on investment. And they blame it all on the millennials. And everybody's made these great efforts to try to quantify how much each dollar given to them translates into meals served or whatever. But to me, a lot of that is misplaced because the bottom, I mean, to me, the bottom line is that many of these people supervising development professionals are not development savvy. And they're focused on the wrong things. You know, I heard about the only person who made an offhand comment to me about not getting $750,000 immediately was the CPA president of the foundation. Even though I was doing something that was in the foundation's long-term best interest, she couldn't see that initially. I mean, she may have seen it on some level, but not on the most important level.
Yeah. Paul, we've had your attention for 55 minutes. We lose our listeners at about 45, so they might not have even, Sally at the food bank might not have even picked up on my novel idea there a few minutes ago. But if there's somebody who's listening to our conversation today, they want to reach out to you and perhaps continue the conversation. They know how to find me, but they want to reach out to you. How would you suggest that they do that?
My website is paulhoodservices.com. And my email is paul@paulhoodservices.com. I'm on LinkedIn as L. Paul Hood Jr. And I'm always willing to help development, charitable organizations, as well as development professionals, because I am concerned that we've lost our way. We are back in the dark ages.
Paul, it's certainly been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.